A third of our reminders is recollection of the consequences of one's actions. Knowing that unskillful actions give rise to misery, and that skillful actions give rise to delight, I shall abandon bad actions and cultivate what is good. So I've got the shortest reminder to talk about, and what seems like the simplest. And it also seems to lead to a delighting, free mind. And yet, there are some questions. What is it that we know in the knowing that unskillful actions give rise to misery? How do we know, or following on from what Kamasuri said yesterday, how deeply do we know that? And if we know it, why don't we do it? So those are my three questions. So first of all, what do we know? This is basic Buddhism, Buddhism 101, the universal principle, the Buddha's main teaching, Paticca Samuppada, conditionality. Bante calls it an alchemical insight. It's the essence of the Buddha's enlightenment, conditioned co-production. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. Simple. We can all go home. Don't end up sounding like Ananda, who one morning comes up to the Buddha, and I'm paraphrasing here, and says to the Buddha, "It's brilliant, Master. Your teaching is so simple. It's profound, but it's so simple. Anyone could understand it." And the Buddha says, "Do not say that, Ananda. Do not say that. This dependent arising is deep and profound. It is not from understanding and penetrating this Dharma that people have become like a tangle of string, covered in mould and matted like grass, unable to escape from samsara with its miseries, disasters, and bad destinies." And that is us. We are a tangle of string, covered in mould, matted like grass, and unable to escape from samsara with its miseries, disasters, and bad destinies, despite having all these blessings and all these endowments. So why? So as we touched on yesterday, there's something about the rational mind knowing Paticca Samuppada. It makes sense. Yes, I know it. Of course. You have that of course moment. Yeah, makes total sense. Then off we go back into life. We need to know it emotionally. We need to know it with citta, with our whole being, our heart mind integrated, and to have had a positive emotional experience of it. We need to be more like Shariputra when he came across Ashvajit on the road. And Ashvajit was one of the first of the Buddha's disciples. And he was a monk and he was walking along a dusty road. And Shariputra had been searching and searching and searching for the answer, for the meaning of life, and to find a teacher. And he comes across Ashvajit and he says, What does your teacher teach?" And Ashvajit says, "Of these things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse." And Shariputra knows. And I read that and I kind of think, eh? Doesn't make any sense. But for Shariputra, it went in. It went deeply in, deeply enough in, that he then became one of the Buddha's disciples. So we need to reflect more deeply. Do we actually believe in Paticca Samuppada? Do we actually believe in conditionality? Do we believe that all things arise in conditions? Or do we believe something else? Is it true? Ehi Pasiko, come and see. Try it out. test it out over and over again. So one way I'm going to suggest that you can reflect on conditionality is through Bhante's exposition of the five niyamas, which were based on Buddha Ghosha's commentaries, where karma, which is in this reflection, is one of the orders by which all things are conditioned, which are conditioned, are bound to conditions. But it does not explain everything in life. Karma does not explain everything in life. It's one of those five niyamas. And I find it really interesting as an ex-scientist and an ex-psychologist to kind of use these niyamas to reflect more broadly on whether I believe that karma is true. So you've got the Utu niyama, UTU. This is non-living matter, inorganic matter. So if you're into and you can think about physics and inorganic chemistry, you can reflect on gravity, electricity, thermodynamics, chemical reactions, water and air quality, and reflect on how they affect everything. You've got the Bija niyama, which is seed or living matter, the realms of biology and organic chemistry, if they interest you. Reflect on your genetics, your gender conditioning, the cells in your body and what they do, birth, decay, death, digestion, what's happening to your porridge right now from this morning, hormones. We've got this thing going on in the house at the moment where hormones play a big part. We're investigating the monthly cycle. And it's very interesting. It's very interesting how much our hormones, if you're perimenopausal or premenopausal, how much they monthly affect you. But also we have women who have gone through the menopause and how the lack of those hormones have affect us. So investigate it, be interested. If you're interested in the environment, look at the effect of cutting down the rainforests on flooding. Look at climate change, investigate it. Look at all the conditions that are coming into play and the effect that they're having. You've got the Chitta Niyama, the heart mind, the realm of psychology as well. Investigate your mental activity. Investigate mental events that are instinctual, like going to eat something, for example, when you're thirsty, instinctively need to drink. The subconscious, the conditioned, the habitual. Investigate it. How much are you actually making a choice in what you do? And then you have the karma niyama. So this is the one that this reflection's on. Skilled actions give rise to delight. Bad actions give rise to misery. So the karma niyama is the willed action of body, speech and mind. It's your volitional consciousness. So it's the self-reflexiveness. It's ethical responsibility. And it's the moral plane. It's where you have a choice. It's where you can plan. It's where your will can come into play. You can be aware or non-aware. You can be kind and unkind. And your vipaka is also involved in this as one of the conditions of this plane. So reality is inherently ethical. The Buddha's response is a natural response. So why don't we do it? Reflect on it. Why don't we have that same response? What else is going on? And by reflecting on and purifying the karma niyama, you can open yourself to the dharma niyama. And really do look out for aspects of the dharma niyama in your life. Don't just assume it's somewhere else, that some other realm of being. It's happening. It's happening all the time. It's the spiritual, the transcendental. We wouldn't be here if you hadn't already been exposed to the Dharma Niyama. You're exposed to it right now. The spiral path to enlightenment. Those conditioned processes by which Buddhas will arise. the stream one enters at stream entry, or has at least had experience of. Reflect on the capacity for enlightenment. It's part of the nature of reality. It's part of Pratichasamutpada. With the correct conditions in place, it is possible for all. And we have those 8 blessings and those 10 endowments. We have got access to the Dharma Niyama. So the Buddha's quest was initially for relief from old age, sickness and death. And the Buddha's answer to that was, again, I'm paraphrasing, ethical action of body, speech and mind. You need to purify that karma niyama. It's the only way. And yet we often focus on still trying to ward off old age, sickness and death in other ways. So the Buddha didn't say, find a cure for cancer. That is the way to eternal life. That is the way to go beyond death. He said, purify the karma niyama. So why? So we have in this culture access to medicine, therapies. We can keep fit. We can do yoga. We can do meditation. And they can all lead us into a God realm, where we forget that the true purpose of those things, of keeping our body healthy, keeping us alive, and of warding off old age and sickness as much as we can, is really to practice. It's not just to ward off sickness and old age. The only place we can actually truly and deeply transform our lives is by taking responsibility for the mental states we now find ourselves burdened with, for whatever reason, for all of those conditions. Taking control of our monkey mind and empowering ourselves to transform through ethical practice. Turning away from becoming self-obsessed, navel gazing, I love navel gazing, and turning towards the whole world, others and ourselves included. So how our lives now will probably be a result of a complex combination of conditioning factors operating from any of the 5 niyamas. All of them are in play all of the time. And only by taking seriously our own ethical responsibility, seriously reflecting on the precepts, and more importantly, our deep practice of them, will our direction be set. Use intuition, instinctive sense. Check it out with others who know you well, your friends, your Kalyana Mitras. Sensitize more and more to that ethical practice. As an interesting thinking about how we try and keep ourselves young and beautiful in our culture. And I looked it up on the internet, and actually the cosmetics industry, which is its main purpose is to keep us looking young and beautiful. So we, as a world, so this must be just the kind of richest nations, spend £300 billion a year, just women, on cosmetics. That's £300 billion a year on keeping ourselves looking young, beautiful. So that means that industry is investing in trying to make us believe that we can stay young and beautiful by investing in cosmetics. And then I thought, well, that's interesting, because we sometimes have these things on the internet where people say, get rid of Trident because it'll end global poverty. And I was thinking, well, compared to how much we spend on cosmetics, how much would it take to actually wipe out global poverty? And somebody, an economist and developmental agencies have worked this out, and they reckon $175 billion to wipe out global poverty. So just over half of the amount that we spend on cosmetics a year could wipe out global poverty. Amazing. So why do we do that? Why do we go down this other route? It's really interesting. The Buddha says, ignore cosmetics. Age beautifully. No. But more seriously, the Dhammapada, chapter 1, verse 1. Again, this is Buddhism 101. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Those who entertain such thoughts as, she abused me, she beat me, she conquered me, she robbed me, will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as, she abused me, she beat me, she conquered me, she robbed me, will still their hatred. Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. Others do not realize that we're all heading for death. Those who do realize it will compose their quarrels. So it seems simple, and then we come on to this third question. Why don't I take my own ethical practice seriously? And I'm talking personally here. Why don't I really believe that my willed actions, whether of my body, of what I'm saying, and what I'm thinking, have consequences in the world? Why do I still want to have for myself rather than give? Why do I want to win an argument rather than to understand what the other person's trying to say? Why do I want to enjoy satisfaction for myself rather than set up conditions for others to experience joy? Why don't I have the Buddha's natural response, that natural ethical sense? And even when I get to that question, I come back to the reflection. And, you know, it says, skillful actions give rise to delight, and unskillful actions give rise to misery. So delight, you know, that feeling of that delighting mind, that free mind, freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. It sounds fantastic, and the moments when you experience it, you know, for me it's momentarily, wow, it's amazing, freedom. And I can really see where we're going. And yet, for some reason, most of us want to stay in misery. We want to remain here for endless ages. We want to remain stuck with our limitations and views, defensive, protective, fragile egos in a sea of threat, as Subhuti says. So why? So I'm one for lists. So the list that touches me on this is definitely the fetters, and particularly the first three fetters. So apologies to anyone who's broken through the first three fetters and is a stream entrant, but, you know, work with the later ones, that's fine. Imagine. Yes. Yeah. So firstly and foremostly, I think one of the key reasons why we don't always practice as ethically as we would like to, even, is this fixed view, the view of a fixed, unchanging self. We're stuck in so many habits of our body, of our speech, and particularly of our mind. And as Bhante says, they're mostly bad ones. The movement to becoming a true individual is just a hard process. It's a hard process of, like, moving away from that view of ourselves. So becoming a true individual would mean not batting up against the universe as an individualist, in constant opposition and conflict with everybody and everything, and not conforming to appease and enable harmony at all costs, including costs to a true individual. So it can be a really extreme practice to be constantly creative, and especially difficult when in contact with people who don't really want us to change. And they want to see us a certain way, and they want to maybe see us as we used to be, or how they even think that we used to be. So that's all the projections you're getting from other people. And particularly the most common cited problem is family, the big one, when you're with your family, because your parents see you a certain way, you see your children a certain way, you see your siblings a certain way, you've grown up habitually behaving in a certain way with each other. However, there's an even bigger one than that. There's ourselves. What we, you know, we think of ourselves as a self. We think we are this person, we have a self view. And we love to have a view of ourselves. We love to have lots of views of ourselves, in fact. We often talk about all our likes and dislikes in general conversation. Oh, I like that. Oh, nice dinner. Yum, yum. Well, I do that. We talk about our dislikes. We talk about our needs. We talk about our wants. We're constantly creating ourselves moment by moment by moment, and the views of ourselves. So notice when yourself comes up against conditionality and you do the equivalent of pouting, stamping your foot and complaining that things aren't going your way and you haven't got what you want. I had a really good example of this earlier, but it's completely gone from my mind. Something I do often. Yeah, it's really slippery. Oh, I know what it is, yes. So I've been the kitchen manager at Tara Loca for 2.5 years. And I noticed this happening when somebody puts something up on our whiteboard saying that something isn't there. There's something missing. Something hasn't been ordered. So we've got a list and it says, for next order or for next shopping trip. And somebody will write up, we need some more washing up sponges. And I immediately have this self-view. But I've done the orders and I know exactly what is there. And I know that I've ordered it and it's definitely there. And before I even go and look, I'll quite often write up, have you checked? Have you checked in the veg store? Because I think there's plenty there. And I did it the other day. And actually then it was only about an hour later I went to check in the veg store myself. And there were loads there and I was right. And I kind of like, yes, aren't I so good? But that is me coming up against my self-view, coming up against in the community of somebody thinking we've run out of washing up sponges. It's such a small thing. Putting it up, oh, we need to order some more washing up sponges. And my self-view as a good kitchen manager coming into play. And the community who's here will probably recognise that very strongly in me. So when do you do that? When do you get into self-righteousness? When do you get into humping or pouting or whatever? In our group, we were talking about Dharma princesses at the beginning of the retreat. This is, and we were talking about, you have to set up exactly the right conditions before you can begin to practice. You know, you have to have everything just so. People have to behave themselves around you as well. You can't, you know, no conflict anywhere. And just the right amount of time to meditate. Right amount of time to reflect, right amount of time to study, with the right study partners, nobody who's annoying in the study group, you know, all of that kind of thing. So becoming a Dharma princess, do you want to do that? Is that what you want to do? And also in the community, we often talk about drama queens, but I was thinking it's a Dharma drama queen. So it's somebody who, and I can be like this as well, somebody who likes to have a lot of intensity. A lot of intensity around, and you know, and when they're talking about their Dharma practice, it's all very, very kind of full on and intense. So I've got a little poem by Jane Hirschfield, which kind of represents this feeling of us creating ourselves over and over again. Red onion, cherries, boiling potatoes, milk. Here is a soul accepting nothing, obstinate as a small child, refusing tapioca, peaches, toast. The cheeks are streaked but dry. The mouth is firmly closed in both directions. Ask if you like. If it is merely sulking or holding out for better, the soup grows cold in the question. the ice cream pools in its dish. Not this is all it knows, not this. As certain cut flowers refuse to drink in the vase, and the heart, from its great distance, watches helpless. So the answer to this view of a fixed, unchanging self is to be creative. Explore the edges. Avoid a comfortable life, sitting on your laurels. Test your boundaries and then break through them. Be free. Quit investing in yourself. Notice when you're doing or thinking the same things over and over again. Why are you invested in that view? Remember, there's no self to defend. There's no self to satisfy. It never will be satisfied. So the second of the three fetters is doubt. Doubt and indecision regarding the Dharma. Doubt and indecision regarding the Dharma. Superficiality. This is about making a commitment to your practice. Integrating the divided self, integrating your rational being and your emotional being, bringing them on board together. Integrating society's values versus your deepest values, standing true in your deepest values. Avoiding living a half-life of comfort and semi-permanent death. The example of this would be, for me, being in front of the TV all the time with really nice food on tap in a comfortable house just the way I want it and no one around to come up against and complain about the lack of washing up sponges. So this is when Mara rocks up. When you're ready to make a commitment, when you do make a commitment, Mara rocks up. We talked about Mitra ceremonies on the first night, having a Mitra ceremony. Mara sometimes rocks up then. When you ask for ordination, Mara can suddenly appear then. When you're being ordained, Mara can appear then. When you're making a commitment to a new way of life, Mara will appear. Any time you make a commitment to your Dharma practice, Mara will appear. I'm going to come back to Mara in a bit. The third fetter, rites and rituals as ends in themselves, or vagueness. And this is a more dishonest vagueness, where you don't actually want to make up your own mind, because then you might have to do something. It's laziness. It's keeping your options open. What's best for me? That kind of thing. What's best for me? I can't work out what's best for me. So make up your mind with clarity. So you've got creativity, commitment, and clarity. And Mara gets worried whenever we start being creative, make deeper commitments, and get clarity. So we met Mara yesterday at nearing the Buddha's death. And I'm just going to talk a bit about the defeat of Mara just before the Buddha's enlightenment. Because Mara appeared in full force at that time. And I find this section of the Buddha's life story really interesting, because it seems to me that it's the last purification that the Buddha has to go through, Siddhartha has to go through before attaining enlightenment. He has to still purify the last of his vipaka, the last of that karma nirma still is in the throes of that. And you've got Mara coming in. But actually he doesn't just arrive, because the Buddha knows he's nearing that point. And similarly to when he knows he's just about to die and he's kind of turning towards it, he realizes he needs to call Mara in at that point and face him face to face and get through these last few bits and pieces. So the Buddha kind of says, okay, I'm nearly there now. Mara, come. So Mara sends in the armies, first of all, and you know the image of him sitting there and, you know, all these weapons, the arrows, the everything being shot at him, boulders, everything, and everything's just turning to flowers. And this, for me, sort of represents fear. I mean, you can read it in all kinds of different ways, but there seems to be a lot of Mara trying to make the Buddha frightened. And what actually happens is that Mara becomes frightened because the Buddha isn't moved by it. And also the Buddha kind of just occasionally just shakes his head and Mara kind of thinks, oh, he swallowed my whole army. Or the Buddha raises his hand just to wipe his brow and Mara thinks that the Buddha's going to hit him. But actually it's kind of like it's turning Mara's own fear back on himself. And later on in that story, you'll remember that Mara then sends in all his daughters being all voluptuous and to kind of get to the Buddha's sense desire and getting him back, you know, back involved in all that kind of life that he'd had when he was a young man with women on tap and beauty and music. And that doesn't work. But there's an even more interesting part of the Mara story, and that's in between those two sections. And that's when Mara actually comes in himself. So Mara is a shapeshifter. So for ages and ages, I thought of Mara as a kind of golem coming in and, you know, my precious, and looking really quite repulsive, and you'd immediately recognise him. And then I realised that often the Buddha had to say, I see you, or I recognise you, or there you are again, Mara. And I was thinking, well, why doesn't he just recognise him? He's this weird looking golem creature. Then I realised Mara's a shapeshifter. And once I realised for myself that Mara's a shapeshifter, I could start seeing my own Maras because they are so subtle. So in this middle section, he goes in as the master of shapeshifting. He goes in as kind of the Buddha's brother, you know, his mate. And he says again, paraphrasing, but hold on, you and I made a pact years ago. We're blood brothers. You know, we were together. I became the king of the realm of desire, and you were going to do that too. You know, you witnessed me doing that. You witnessed me offering myself to the realm of desire. I haven't seen it. You witnessed yourself. I haven't seen you do anything. Haven't you seen yourself offer yourself to anyone? Nobody's seen you. You're delicate. You know, you were brought up in these fine palaces. You're not worthy. Who do you think you are? You're not going to be attaining enlightenment in this lifetime. You're too delicate. You're used to beautiful women. You have to have palaces, you know, one for the heat and one for the cold because you're too delicate. You like delightful music. You're educated. You had cheery friends around you, a life of luxury. You're kidding yourself. You're born to lead, but not in this way. Come on. Slightly subtle, slightly kind of, I don't know, next to the Buddha, kind of, you know, not confronting him, just next to him. But the Buddha isn't touched by this. Instead, he touches the earth, calls the earth as his witness with depth, gravity, love, compassion, and true power. And he says, this earth, the home of all beings, is impartial and free of malice towards everything which moves or does not move. Here is the guarantee that there is no deception. Take the earth as my witness. And as the Bodhisattva touched the great earth, it trembled in six ways. It trembled strongly. Trembled strongly on all sides, resounded strongly on all sides. Just as the bronze bells from Magadha ring out when struck with a stick, so this great earth resounded and resounded again when touched by the hand of the Bodhisattva. Then the goddess of the earth that is in this world realm of the 3,000 great thousands of worlds, surrounded by a following of 100 times 10 million earth goddesses, shook the whole great earth. Not far from the Bodhisattva, she revealed the upper half of her body, adorned with all its ornaments, and bowing with joined palms, spoke thus to the Bodhisattva. Just so, great beings, it is indeed as you have declared it. We appear to attest to it. Moreover, you yourself have become the supreme witness of both the human and God realms. In truth, you are the purest of all beings. Having frustrated the guile of Mara with these words, the great earth goddess honoured and praised the Bodhisattva and showed it in several ways her own power. Then with her following, she disappeared. Having heard the voice from the earth, the deceiver and his army, terrified and broken, begin to flee. Like foxes in the woods who hear the lion's roar, like crows at the fall of a clump of earth, all suddenly dispersed. So to conclude or summarize, we need to deeply know, not just rationally know things, really know them, feel them in our being. Explore, try out, come and see, Ehipasiko. You could use reflection on the five niyamas to see through into Pratichasamutpada. You could take your ethical practice seriously as the only real escape from suffering, the only real way towards freedom, and open yourself to the Dharma Niyama. Explore it for yourself. Is this true? And face Mara head on. Take confidence in yourself as a serious Dharma practitioner. Call on the earth as your witness. So I'll just finish with Vishvapani's version of this reminder. Everywhere I look in the universe, I see things arising and passing away in dependence upon conditions. From galaxies and stars to microorganisms, this pattern holds true. Things aren't random, they have causes and effects. This is also true of my life. What I am today is the product of many influences. My family, my culture, my education, and relationships. It's also the product of choices I've made, of how I've acted, of my mental states and habits. There are many things I cannot alter, and these I must accept. But I can change those conditions that spring from my mind. I can change how I think. I can affect how I feel. Meditation and Dharma practice give me the ways to do so. I know that skillful actions have brought me happiness and fulfillment and have benefited others. When I've been kind or generous, I've seen others benefit, and it has given me happiness. I know that my unskillful actions have harmed others and harmed me too. When I have been unkind, I have seen the pain I have caused. Those actions have reinforced negative states of mind that make me unhappy, and I've felt remorse and regret. Therefore, I should cultivate positive states, practice skillful actions, and avoid the unskillful ones. This means practicing the Dharma, which offers a sure path to establishing positive conditions. To this path, I commit myself.